And let me, there we go. All right, good morning, everyone, and welcome, welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And, you know, we've been slowly but surely working our way through the newest book by Gary Renard, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, History of Mighty Companions. And last week I was not here because I was off gallivanting in Kansas with my sister and her family at their lovely 25th wedding anniversary party. And boy, did I have fun. I played bingo, and we went to this gospel. It was sort of like a propaganda tour of this Christian group from Tennessee or something. And oh my goodness! And the one girl sang Disney songs. So she sang all the Disney princess songs. She was had a beautiful voice. And then the other girl was a little more hippie, and she, you know, did the more hippier songs. But a lot of their music, I mean, they did the Battle Hymn of the Republic they sang. And everybody stood up and sang Glory, Glory, Hallelujah. And and they sang Dixie. Can you believe it? Oh, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten.
All you have to do is go into a clothing store to be in the land of cotton, right? Or, unless you're in the synthetics department. Right?
It just amazed me to be in a, sitting in an audience listening to this rhetoric and this music. And then there were a lot of songs about dying soldiers. And I thought, what are they trying to tell us here? And I asked my sister, who's, you know, this was her fundamentalist Christian, you know, thing here. And I asked her later, I said, what was all the deal about the dying soldiers? And she goes, well, that's patriotism, Lynn. I said, oh, okay. I was confused. I didn't realize that singing about dying soldiers was patriotic. But that's... News to me. Anyway, so what have you been up to, Bruce? Anything interesting happening in the world?
Oh, it's just the usual multi-ring circus. But having fun with doing lots of different things in terms of mostly, you know, what I stare at almost all day long is this computer and doing web stuff. And I'm really grateful because, you know, a large percentage of my clients are about A Course in Miracles. So I get the... You know, the non-dual metaphysics, you know, just almost by osmosis because of, you know, what I'm working with and working on. So, for example, I've been rebuilding all the weekly thought graphics over the last few weeks and putting them in this new website. And so it's kind of fun to, you know, get the reminders. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, like the one I'm starting right now is do not perceive yourself in different lights. Know yourself in the one light where the miracle that is you is perfectly clear. And, of course, you know, that's basically, you know, another restatement of the pure non-duality of A Course in Miracles. And that's why when we have experiences that seem to be challenging, it's only because whether it's, you know, a family visit that exposes us to things that we find challenging, it's like, well, it's every single experience we have in this world is an opportunity to look at the projections that we have and see how that is an opportunity to reintegrate something we thought we'd given away or lost or abandoned or you know, whatever, and bring it back inside our identity and recognize that, you know, nothing possibly could have escaped that all-encompassing oneness that we all share and are. So anyway,
exactly. And what was I going to ask you here in the midst of all that? Oh yeah. What was that you just read and where is it located? Can you read that?
Sure. That's from chapter 3, section 5, paragraph 10, sentence 8 through 9 in the text. And of A Course in Miracles. And it is, I'll read it again, is do not perceive yourself in different lights. Know yourself in the one light where the miracle that is you is perfectly clear. And then, of course, you know, again, it's just basically restating that we just have the one self, And with a capital S that we all share, and the little S self that we think we are, is what makes life so confusing. You know, we think that there's other people. We think that there's a world that is peopled with different things, and we're only part of it, and there's all these fragments of different things, and each fragment, is part of bigger fragments, and each fragment, in the biological world, each fragment makes more fragments, and complexity builds upon itself, and it's a whacked out dream. But there's nothing wrong with it. It just means that we need to look at the belief that is the fundamental belief that really made this world. And I think that's why today's workbook lesson, it says, most very emphatically, and Jesus doesn't mince any words in his course. He says, there is no world. This is the central thought the course attempts to teach. And that's how we loose this world from all that we thought it was, right? So.
Well, exactly, and that's it's such a fundamental shift. And when Jesus says that a miracle is a shift in perception, a lot of people think that means that I change my mind about what I see, which is what we learn. This is what we're taught. This is what we learn, and this is what the course is mainly about: changing my mind about what I think I see. But the actual shift in perception is not just changing my mind about what I think I see. The actual shift in perception is seeing reality and not seeing a dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since you mentioned the word perception, I know what the Course intends with the word perception, but I find myself oftentimes, enhancing my understanding of that by using the word interpretation. Because perception to me is more of like the biological, which again is part of the dream, but, just the mechanism by which photons come and strike the retina and the nerve impulses go to the brain and sound waves register on the eardrum and get transferred through the inner ear. And, all that yada yada stuff of the biological processes. To me, that's more how I usually think of the word perception. But the interpretation is what we do with our mind. The brain is going to make its associations because that's part of the biological machinery. But the mind is really what this wonderful non-dual metaphysical curriculum suggests, is that that's where the real freedom lies. It's not in changing what photons arrive at our retinas or what sound waves impinge upon our eardrums. I mean, that's going to be what it is by whatever script that we're in.
Yeah.
And we can make some little minor changes in that, relative to, galactic, to local standards, but not so much galactic. We're not going to suddenly find ourselves, most of us anyway, on a different planet in a different galaxy kind of thing, having a totally different experience. But we can make minor changes and rearrange, our office and the contents of our refrigerator, that kind of stuff. But in terms of the big changes in the world, it's much harder to do those things. But that's not what we're being asked to do. We're asked to change how we interpret the things that we appear to perceive. And I put the word appear in there because that's such a helpful word to me, is when I remember that this is a world of appearances, and that, this is essentially a hologram that on some level that we all chose to forget about, we made up a world in response to an unconscious guilt that was founded on a faulty premise that suggested that we were able to separate from that perfect oneness in the first place, which this wonderful curriculum suggests just ain't true. It's a lie. Yeah.
And so that talk about perception, see, this is how we think perception is: I see the things in front of me, I hear the things in the sounds and the waves in the air, I feel this sensation of my hand on my knee, I taste this coffee. This is how we're perceiving perception, as the input to the sensory of the world. But perception is not the input of the sensory of the world. Perception is a judgment that this thing is different than that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's all. You know, I could change the word perception to judgment, and because I've worked so hard on learning how to interpret judgment as being not a assignment of guilt, but judgment is just being a distinguishing between one thing and another, and saying this thing is different than that thing. And so the whole purpose of perception is, I mean, if you didn't have perception, you would be banging into the furniture. You know, if you didn't have perception, you would be, you know, eating burning coals. You know, you...
Stay away from those briquettes, Lynn. They're not. You're not going to like the taste. Trust me.
This charcoal is more painful than when you banged into the wall yesterday or whatever, because we're eating perception. That's not what Jesus is talking about. He's not talking about, you know, don't see the differences in the world that you already see because you believe differences exist, because that is an unworthy form of denial. To say, oh, I don't perceive it because, you know, but what he's saying is that there is a point of knowing in which you are no longer deceived by the appearance of things that are in front of you, and in fact, the things that appear in front or around you, you are completely in control of. You know, this is what Jesus did. He didn't see his hand as different than the nail that was going through it, nor did he know his body as different from the wood that he was hanging on, you know, when he was crucified, whatever. He didn't, because he did not identify with the perception. That he didn't identify with the perception of the body, the perception of the walking or carrying or the weather or the rain. He didn't identify with those perceptions because he knew that it was all projection. He knew that as his experience, not intellectually, but he experienced it that way. And so what we're asking is, in this, did you say that was chapter 3? Section 5, paragraph 6?
10.
That you would read. 10. Oh, 10. Well, good, because I went up to paragraph 6 and I read this. It says, it's talking about prayer being the medium of miracles. And he says, the prayer for forgiveness is nothing more than a request that you may be able to recognize that what you already have. In electing perception instead of knowledge, you placed yourself in a position where you could resemble your father only by perceiving miraculously. You have lost the knowledge that you yourself are a miracle of God. Creation is your source and your only real function. And so my real function is actual creation. And what's happening is I've replaced it with this perception. And Jesus says, I can perceive miraculously, which, what does that mean? Well, what is a miracle? A miracle is a shift in perception. I can perceive from the direction of the world being not true, not real, and having no effect. I can perceive from the direction of being the holy, innocent, and powerful, beloved Son of God, who is a co-creator with my Father. I can perceive from that direction, in which then nothing of the world, that world of perception, has any meaning to me. And therefore, I don't have to intervene. I need do nothing except not to interfere. I don't have to intervene with the life of Lynn and the body. I don't have to intervene with politics or the weather. I don't have to intervene with anything in the illusion. I don't have to believe that I'm responsible for it and feel guilty when none of it is perfect, which is basically what we do, recognize that nothing is perfect and therefore we're guilty and because we can't change it and make it right. So anyway, So that shift in perception that we're talking about is really a shift from being the Christ, being the ego, to being the Christ mind. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, how Jesus did it, and how he's telling us to do it. And he's telling us to hurry it up and get a move on, because there's a celestial speed up happening here. So anyway.
And yet we have all the time in this imaginary world to do it. But the as you point out, you know, the suggestion is, you know, why wait for heaven? Why needlessly suffer when the world really by default is one of suffering? But if when we see it in a different light, the one light, as that quote I made suggest, you know, that we recognize, you know, that if we see ourselves as part of the capitalist self and inseparable from that, that the true being that we all share, and not just isolated and limited to a Lynn or a Bruce or a whoever else it might be listening to this that, you know, has a name and a body and a persona and a, you know, history and all kinds of things appended in that belief of being separate. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that that doesn't bring us peace. And when we're not at peace, you know, we're basically, you know, suffering needlessly, because we have the opportunity to choose against the misinterpretation. It doesn't mean we have to do battle with it. We just need to say, hey, this isn't working for me. And just as you would walk away from a buffet of horrible food that none of which you like, you can just say, hey, I'd rather have, you know, a gourmet fare of the delicacies that are healthy and that I enjoy and that have wonderful flavors and aromas. And you know, it's really, you know, just kind of, it's a night and day kind of choice. Ultimately, there's really a thought system of peace that has a completely consistent quality to it, and then there's a thought system that you know, is less than happy, and we go back and forth from that with that between those two all the time. But the idea is to just consistently choose that place of peace in the mind where we have let go of the identity that doesn't serve us, which is separate and apart.
Exactly. And up in that same section that you were reading, up on paragraph 8, it says, what happens to perceptions if there are no judgments and nothing but perfect equality? Perception becomes impossible. And that's it. If I'm not judging, I can't perceive. Mm-hmm. That, so what happens if I just stop, then, you know, what I perceive will no longer appear real, I guess. You know, well, I won't even be able to perceive, apparently. So that's a state we are pretty fearful of, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, I've asked myself the question, and my husband asked me, what the heck is wrong with you? You know what you need to do. You know how you need to do it. You know why. You know, why do you wait? You know, of course, Jesus asks us the same thing.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Why do we hesitate? Why do we wait? Why do we hold back from giving all? You know, and it's a good, very good question that I ask myself every day, and I don't have a satisfying answer other than I'm afraid.
Yeah.
You know, I'm afraid of once I do that, once I just say, all right, no more, I'm not going to fight it, no more resistance, and I'm just going to just completely think with the Holy Spirit every moment of every day, which means basically that, you know, I think that when things come up that are not that thinking, I just have to reject it and then, you know, just continue on. And every time a thought comes up that is not Holy Spirit thought, you know, which is Jesus gives us all these examples of what our real thoughts are or could be in this world, and yet we choose all these other thoughts, and it's just changing the thoughts. That's it. So All right. Well, anyway, enough of these ramblings.
Well, I think we might be covering a few helpful things. It's always helpful to me. And you know, one thing that you said a moment ago kind of reminded me of something that I found helpful is that, you know, that if I can remember that this world was designed to make differences important, and in fact, that's how actually biologically how we our perceptions work. Even, you know, they don't even function without contrast and differences. An example of that, if you're an artist or a photographer, if you have a blank canvas and there's no difference between one pixel or another, you know, if they're all the same value, then you know the polar bear and a snowstorm kind of, you know, that if you can't make out anything that's different from anything else, in fact, the course even says, you know, that the perfect oneness that we really have never left, you know, is something to the fact, I'm going to paraphrase this, where no part sufficiently distinct from any other part to, you know, basically make a problem. That's where I'm adding my 2 cents worth. But you know, if you think about, you know, a great work of art or a photograph or whatever, that, you know, it's usually this stark contrast, and, you know, it's those tonal values that of lights and darks or different colors, or in music it's different sounds and different pitches and volumes and harmonics, and, you know, but that's all based on differences. But yet the real music, the real beauty that we can only get a glimpse of, and it's a reflection in our minds in this world, is the oneness that really is responsible for everything that truly brings us any kind of inner peace or joyousness or loving kindness, that has no polarity at all. I mean, how can what is, you know, completely one and all inclusive have an opposite? And that's what, you know, it's kind of beyond our rational understanding, which, you know, the rational mind, even the word ratio, you know, is kind of like a dividing, right? It's because we like to split things up and separate and put things in boxes, and the boxes that we, you know, are particularly skilled at in this world is bodies. You know, that's the box that we think that we're limited to, but the mind is completely unlimited and goes wherever it needs to go, because in truth that awareness is everywhere and everyone and everything, and not limited to bodies at all. But
exactly, and you can't perceive that. We can't imagine that. Mm-hmm. We can't. It's like imagining God, you know, think about God. What does God mean to you? And you know, I mean, you can't imagine it because it's the ego is so limited in its ability to see the truth. It can't see anything. In fact, if you can see it, it's not the truth. So you know, try to imagine, you know, what true peace is, or try to imagine heaven, or try to, you know, we can only imagine it in terms of our own perception, which means that there's lots of different things there. And if we imagine it as being this great light, golden place or whatever, white light or whatever that Jesus talks about, it sounds incredibly boring. And absolutely, my God, what would I do? Because there's what are you talking about? I don't want that. Please, you know, don't send me to a heaven where there's no this or that or the other. And yet, you know, he talks about it as being, you know, indescribably joyful. Mm-hmm. So the ego can't perceive that, can't understand what that is. And so you'll never have that clear picture in your mind of where you're going or what it's all about, just like you'll never have that clear picture in your mind of what God is until you have no more pictures in your mind at all. Mm-hmm. It's that picture that is the... you know, has caused all the trouble. So, you know,
yeah, like Plato's allegory of the cave. You know, if all you know is darkness and maybe it's just a little dim shadows of, you know, that are cast by the interferences to light. You know, we're going to have a pretty distorted perception of what reality is, and you know, imagining those poor souls, you know, chained together in this cave through, you know, who knows how long, you know, trying to imagine, you know, soaring high in the stratosphere, you know, and having a spectacular vista. It's like, well, that's not even on their radar anywhere. You know, they don't even have a radar.
They have no need for radar.
Yeah.
Well, and that's basically where we are and how we are. Yeah. Is that we can't perceive of that.
Yeah, and we anthropomorphize everything too, because you know we try to, you know, and that's why the course is pitched at the level of where we think we're at is, you know, because we think of ourselves as bodies, so the course comes to us in the ego framework where it's needed. I was thinking a moment ago when you were sharing something, Linda, it's like, you know, our usual picture of God probably for a lot of people is some you know humanoid looking thing, and the last few years I. If I want to think of a, you know, kind of a silly archetype, I picture the bearded guy that appears on Stephen Colbert's dome ceiling in the Late Show, you know. I mean, because that's kind of the picture that we're given, you know, in at least in my group upbringing, you know, and Sunday school kind of things, you know, you got this literature of, you know, this bearded guy who you know, this long white beard kind of thing, this sometimes vengeful and sometimes benevolent, and you know, Old Testament kind of thing. But it's as the course says, it's we find it very difficult to conceive of that perfect oneness as not having some kind of form, and that's, you know, just indicative of how invested we are in level of confusion and wanting to make it about the world and make it about fixing the dream and making it, you know, work in where it's never going to work. But anyway, should we go back to a little bit of reading from Gary's
sure, book? Sure. Yeah, and you're right. No matter how hard you try, you know, I can't imagine what God looks like, because God can't. There is no God. Doesn't look like anything. It is actually just a knowing, and. You know, how do you know? Well, you know, you felt it, and we've all felt it. This is the thing. The ego would tell you when you've had these experiences where you have felt totally loved, totally, you know, glimpse of heaven in your dream, in your waking time, sometime where you've had this incredible, and you've had these over and over and over through your lifetimes, these feelings of closeness and oneness and goodness and joy and all these things that came out of nowhere that had no real reason, but that just gave you this experience of connection to the universe. And you know, I don't know, just stop and think about this. Have you had these feelings? When did you have these feelings? And what did your mind tell you about these feelings? Because that's what the ego does, is it says, oh, that wasn't real, or, you know, it just was, you know, you're imagining things or whatever, because the ego doesn't want you to acknowledge those experiences. But when I start thinking about those times when I've had, you know, literally heard a voice telling me what to do, seeing things that show me depth of understanding of something far beyond what I could have known intellectually. These things come, and instead of saying, wow, that's wonderful, and continuing to focus on that experience to reinforce that in ourselves, that it is possible that we can have divine communication and intervention in our lives, we push it away and say that didn't really happen, or you know, I was imagining things, or you know, maybe it was the wind, or you know, all kinds of reasons why that didn't really happen. And I'm just encouraging anybody at this moment, if you have those experiences or have had them, to bring them up in your mind and to look at them with the Holy Spirit and ask to be shown, or to be able to remember that feeling, that nostalgia. That is the sound of heaven when you listen and you can hear that far away sound. You know that you have that connection to heaven. Anyway,
isn't there a saying that nostalgia ain't what it used to be?
That's right. And actually, that's something the TAP Foundation, Richard Rose, that started the TAP Foundation. That's a big part of their teaching, is that nostalgia for heaven. And, you know, when you recognize what it is, instead of rejecting it, look at it and recognize that it's your soul, you know, reaching out for its home, basically. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we are in Gary Renard's book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we are in the chapter about Gnosticism, I believe.
Uh-huh.
And
I have us about page 104. I was thinking maybe we should back up a paragraph or two.
Okay, yeah, I bookmarked us on 103. So,
oh, okay, perfect.
So, yeah, yeah, if you want to start reading,
okay,
wherever you see
okay
fit.
Actually, maybe at the right at the bottom of 102, because that seems like a section starts there. Okay, I'll go ahead and start then. Persa, there's a quote we want you to use somewhere in the book. It's from the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And this is the quote. I said to him, Lord, what allows one to see a vision? Do we see it with the soul or with the spirit? He answered and said to me, quote, one sees not through the soul or the spirit, but through the mind, which is between these two, unquote. That was recorded by Mary Magdalene at the time we all hung out. This is what it means. First, the quote is translated from the Nag Hammadi writings, asks, what allows one to see a vision? It should ask, what allows one to see with a vision? That's what Mary was asking. Jay, for the benefit of those listening, she already knew the answer. The soul, although considered to be very spiritual by most, is actually a separation idea because it's an idea of individuality or personal existence. Everyone thinks they have an individual soul. It doesn't matter if the idea of individuality involves a body or not. Separation is separation. Also, the quote doesn't really need to say, quote, the spirit, unquote, but just spirit. Spirit is all there is, and it is oneness. So right away you see you have two ideas in the quote from Mary's Gospel, the idea of separation or the idea of oneness. The reason Jay said, quote, one sees not through the soul or spirit, but through the mind, which is between these two, unquote, is that it's the mind's function to choose. You use the mind to choose either the idea of separation, which is the course, which in the course is represented mostly by the body, but also the human psyche, in effect, individual soul, or to choose spirit, which is perfect oneness. Whichever one you get into the habit of choosing will be what you think is real. It will become what you believe in, and thus what it is that affects you. You can see that Jay was teaching the same thing 2,000 years ago, and that he's teaching today through A Course in Miracles. In fact, he says in the Course, quote, the term mind is used to represent the activating agent of spirit, supplying its creative energy, unquote. You activate spirit by choosing it with the mind. Get it? Gary, got it. Of course, 2,000 years ago, he couldn't usually put things the way he does in the Course, or else no one would have understood him, not that most of them understood him anyway. So I take it that's why he spoke mostly in parables. Persa, yes, sayings and parables. Now, Gnosticism became popular after the earlier Gospels of Thomas, Mary, and Philip, as well as the later Gospels you see today in the Bible, which were always being changed. Today, because of Christianity, Thomas, Mary, and Philip are incorrectly thought of as being Gnostic. In fact, Philip is considered to have come from the Valentinian school, but that's not true. The original version of it was pre-Christian and pre-Gnostic. Still, as we told you once through your mind, it was Valentinus who understood the best of all the Gnostics. Valentinus was born in Alexandria, where he got to use the library like Jay and his friends did. And the Library of Alexandria is a place I've thought it'd be fascinating to be a time traveler and go back and do with a camcorder and a translator, an interview with Hypatia, the librarian there, and ask her, you know, which her thoughts about well, not only what was there, but in the library, but in her mind as far as what she found meaningful. I bet there would be a lot of Gnostic ideas and things that were, you know, reminiscent of non-dual metaphysics. But, also, a quick aside, if people are interested in a more scholarly treatment of how Gnosticism and Platonism and, you know, Valentinus and all these people, you know, led up to, you know, certainly Christianity and you know, a lot of different religious interconnections, and particularly, of course, miracles. Ken Wapnick has a book called Love Does Not Condemn that is a scholarly treatment of that. And I'm just barely into it. I've only read, I don't know, a tiny percent of it, and I'm taking it very slowly, reading a little at a time. But you might want to check that out. So, do you want to continue?
What is it called?
It's called Love Does Not Condemn. I think it's probably one of his more scholarly books, yeah, if not the most. But he, you know, at least the part that I've read so far, he's just discussing the historical precedence of these different teachings and how they relate to non-duality. But it's really interesting. I mean, how, you know, again, it's, to me, the take-home lesson is always, you know, how can I remember that we're all the same because, and not separate, because even throughout history, you know, there's always been that thought system that wants to divide and make separate and try to justify and, you know, identify with dualistic things because of fear. And then there's always the place in the mind that is where loving kindness reminds us that all differences are made up and can be safely discarded in terms of, you know, our identity. Now, obviously, we can't abandon them in terms of our everyday navigation through this dream world, but in terms of our identity, that's what we're asked to more and more just, you know, question. Is a separate identity really working for me? So anyway, do you want to read further or comment on what we've read so far?
Yeah, I'll read from here if you want. So he's talking about the Library of Alexandria, which I've often wondered what really it was that, because, you know, did they have, scrolls, paper, you know, obviously they wouldn't have, or maybe they did have, printed books and bound and that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's hard to know because, this is like around, you know, AD 150, it's saying here.
They probably had computer terminals that showed the cuneiform tablets and the scrolls, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Carrie is saying that it was maybe collapsed in a quake, an earthquake, too. That's, you know, these things, well, we're just going to read about it here. Gary says, didn't the library burn down? And Persa, and he was just we're talking about the folks that studied at the library, including Philip, who was one of the original apostles, I guess. So anyway, didn't the library burn down? Persa, yes, there were several fires that caused various degrees of damage, but there was a surviving form of the library called the Serapeum up until AD 391 or so. Or Serapeum, I don't know how you pronounce that.
Serapeum, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah, Serapeum.
Sorry, no, I didn't go there, but that's pretty funny. Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Anyway, Sarah, she's in the news again. Anyway,
Pam, just to be distinct from, yeah. Palin, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Speaking of which, if you want a good laugh, there's a Michael Palin has a video. Uh-oh. Saying that he should be the candidate for president from several years ago, obviously. If you Google Michael Palin for president, you'll find it. It's pretty funny.
Oh, I love that because I love Michael Palin. He's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so yes, Persa says, there were several fires that caused various degrees of damage, but there was a surviving form of the library called the Serapeum up until AD 391 or so. Valentinus established schools known as part of the Syrian Egyptian schools of Gnosticism in Alexandria and Rome around AD 150. It was there the amazing Gospel of Truth was written. Valentinus was influenced by a teacher named Basilides, who also had popular schools. Plus, there were other Gnostic teachers, but they weren't so good as good at grasping the principles of J. It was Valentinus' teachings that were the most influential Gnostic teachings until the late 4th century. Then, as we've been saying, all the writings except for the mainstream Gospels became illegal and were wiped out. The reason we bring this up is that there's a parallel between Gnosticism and J's new form of the same teachings in A Course in Miracles, and thank you for that link. Some people have a gift for recognizing what the original teachings are saying. As you know, in the case of Gnosticism, it was Valentinus. His students were attracted to him because they recognized the truth of what he was teaching. They didn't go to him because of his personality, but because they could see he was non-dualistic, and they resonated with it. In the case of the Course, it was Ken Wapnick who had the gift for recognizing what the Course was saying, and today students are attracted to Ken's work, not because of his personality, but because they recognize the truth in what he was teaching in his long, prolific career before he made his transition. The Course is non-dualistic, and so is Ken's work. Yours is also because you had us right from the beginning. Plus, since we first came to you, on our advice, you've learned from Ken as well. It's no accident Ken was there at the beginning with Helen Schuckman, Bill Thetford, and Judy Scutch. He was supposed to be the one to teach the Course. The wisest students learn from him. Boy, that is quite true. I listen to Ken almost every day. Mm-hmm. Others think they can teach the Course better, but they don't. They think Ken just made one possible theory of what the Course means, his interpretation. But it's not a theory. There is only one possible correct interpretation of the Course. It says what it says, and Ken taught what it said better than anyone. And that is really the crux of all of this is when people, this is Lynn talking, not Gary, but when people think that they can read the Course and come up with a better interpretation or a better understanding or whatever, and then they get into talking about, the body will live forever because Jesus says it cannot die. And, they totally miss the point that the body isn't even real, so how could it live or die? You know, teachers pick up this Course and think that they, even knowing it for a couple years, they can write a book about it, and, they become teachers and get people following them, and what they're teaching is hogwash. They'll talk about forgiveness in terms of dealing with things that people have done to you or that you've done to other people. They completely miss the picture of what A Course in Miracles is telling us, and Ken was drop dead right on the entire time. He never went into any superstitious beliefs, any things that the church taught about what's good and bad and right and wrong. He knew completely that there is no good and bad and right and wrong, that this world is an illusion, and that is really all he taught. And there are so many Course in Miracles teachers that are even today say a miracle has to be, a miracle isn't really a miracle unless there's some physical change that happens. You can heal the sick and raise the dead and bring make the blind man see. They think this, they're still thinking that's a miracle, and they're teaching A Course in Miracles and have been studying it for years. So, resign as your own teacher, resign as my teacher, because you don't know a thing about what Jesus is saying if you're saying these things and thinking these things. There's no condition under which the world has any meaning. No condition.
Well, today's workbook lesson really says it all. There is no world. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach, meaning that our projections are a hallucination, and doesn't mean we ignore them, doesn't mean we deny them, which of course is a particularly unworthy form of denial, but to deny the body in the world, as a as the sensory data. Maybe perception isn't the best word because it sort of implies interpretation and, of course, use of it. But the sensory aspect, it's not saying deny the senses. It just says deny the ego's interpretation, which is really basically to say, you know, get the cloud out of the way that says it can stop buttons, but, you know, a button can fall through a cloud, as one of the videos I was watching of Ken's this morning was saying. You know, it's like, how could we be concerned about something that really can't stop what is from returning to our mind? And you know, there's no harm in it, but it's just, you know, why suffer needlessly? Why wait for the return of that place in our mind that we never left by belaboring a world that is really about the laborers of the ego of trying to make big deals out of everything so that we don't look at the cause of the fear and ultimately release it. So.
Oh, I'm getting messages. Okay.
Okay.
And that's it. Exactly. This whole notion, what Jesus says very clearly, you can't live in both worlds. You can't live in two worlds. And that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, 100% living in the thinking of the Holy Spirit all the time, or I'm 100% living right now. I'm pretty much 100% living in the ego world. And it's only by choices that I make on an active level that I'm, you know, really thinking with the Holy Spirit. And so, you know, it's true. If I'm thinking with the Holy Spirit, the world has no meaning to me. If I'm thinking with the world, the Holy Spirit has no meaning to me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's just a choice. Pick one or the other. I need to go and do something really quickly. So I'm going to just mute my mic and let you continue reading, and I'll be right back.
Sure, I'll pick up where we left off. Okay.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to back up a little bit. I'm reading from page 104, about the middle of the page, in Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other. And I'm going to back up to where we read a moment ago. The reason we bring this up is that there's a parallel between Gnosticism and Jay's new form of the same teachings in A Course in Miracles. Okay, some people have a gift for recognizing what the original teachings were saying. As you know, in the case of Gnosticism, it was Valentinus. His students were attracted to him because they recognized the truth of what he was teaching. They didn't go to him because of his personality, but because they could see that he was non-dualistic and they resonated with it. In the case of the Course, it was Ken Wapnick who had the gift for recognizing what the Course was saying. And today, students are attracted to Ken's work, not because of his personality, but because they recognize the truth in what he was teaching in his long and prolific career before I made his transition. The Course is non-dualistic, and so is Ken's work. Yours is also because you had us right from the beginning. Plus, since we first came to you, on our advice, you learned from Ken as well. It's no accident that Ken was there at the beginning with Helen Schuckman, Bill Thetford, and Judy Sketch. He was supposed to be the one to teach the Course. The wisest students learn from him. Others think they can teach the Course better, but they can't. They think Ken just had one possible theory of what the Course means, his interpretation. But it's not a theory. There is only one possible correct interpretation of the Course. It says what it says, and Ken taught what it said better than anyone. Gary, I've been meaning to ask you, was Ken enlightened? Persa, yes, he was. Ken left the illusion because it was his time. Everyone has an appointed place and time when they're going to make their transition. You don't change that by becoming enlightened. The script is written. If you're enlightened, then you lay your body aside for the final time. It's not important that Ken appeared to pass away in the dream. What was important was how he was looking at it. He said at the end, quote, I'm not dying, unquote, because he realized that the body and personality had, personally, some people thought was him, wasn't him at all. The body had become meaningless to him, as with Jay. It was the same with Bill Thetford, the co-scribe of the Course. You know from Judy that he was enlightened. Note, I had become good friends with Judy Sketch Whitson, president of the Foundation for Inner Peace, the original publisher of the Course, who, as Persa pointed out, was there at the Course's origins. Judy told me she believed that Bill was, quote, the first one to graduate from the Course, unquote. Having seen videos of Bill speaking in the 1980s, I saw nothing that wouldn't confirm what she was saying. Gary. That's great that at least two of the original four course people were enlightened, and I see no reason to think Judy isn't. I know that Helen Schuckman, despite completely understanding the course, had a hard time when it came to actually doing it. But everything Ken told me he really applied it. Artin, yes, he did. And we're pleased that you've gotten better and better at doing the same. Persa, since we've been emphasizing non-dualism so much, would you like to briefly review the four steps on the ladder to pure non-dualism? And before we do that, I'm just going to kind of pause and say, I think, again, the value of this is not to be comparative, but to recognize that, you know, progress is possible, and we can, it doesn't matter whether a particular person is enlightened or not enlightened. I think that's again, you know, the ego trying to understand things from a here and there, having a not having dualistic perspective of thinking that there's something that needs to be done or achieved, when it's really the undoing of our identity as a seemingly separate self. That's really the whole point. So to say that a seemingly separate self became enlightened kind of misses the whole point, doesn't it? It just is basically another way of reinforcing the idea that there is, you know, something in the dream that needs fixing, and that's contrary to what this curriculum is suggesting. So, okay, now we're good. Sounds like you're back, Lynn?
Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so we're just starting in about the four steps on the ladder to pure non-dualism. Yeah. Do you want to pick up from there, or shall I go on?
Sure. So Gary says, this is the four steps on the ladder. So he says, sure. First you have dualism. That's the domain of subject and object expressed by Newtonian physics. Things appear to be outside of you. That's where consciousness comes from. Even though the universe is a projection, you don't know it. You know, and that's what Jesus says, that consciousness is the first split. Mm-hmm. And that's really what brought about this idea of duality. And he also says, it's very interesting, because I'm always reading the course and he's saying you and another, you and join with another. But he says in one place that the other is really yourself. And I mean, of course he says that all the time, but the separation that I experience between me and myself, that I'm talking to myself, that I'm listening to myself, that I'm, you know, I sound like the president if he talks to himself and says, I should do this and I should do that. That's really what's happening, is the other is actually always myself. Mm-hmm. Then I'm, even if it appears to be a different person or whatever, it's always just me and myself having a conversation about what I'm perceiving.
Yeah, yeah, and we may not be clinically paranoid schizophrenic as the world defines it, but from the course's perspective, we're all schizophrenic because we're all trying to hold two identities of you know, the self that we, the capitalist self that we, on some level or another, we all know is true, and everyone has that awareness, whether it's a Hitler or a Genghis Khan or a contemporary fascist of whatever stripe or ilk. Yeah, but those are all symbols of aspects of our split mind that we've projected out so that we can learn from our misogynistic, narcissistic, xenophobic, insane, crazy, whacked out, basically dualistic nonsense that suggests that differences are important and real. And you know, at some level or another, we know that that's bogus, but that the true self, the real self that we all are and have and share, you know, knows that's crazy. But that's why, you know, we're all in the same schizophrenic basket here until we, you know, finally let go of any investment in our identity, program of thinking that our peace of mind is going to come from something in a projected world that even science, you know, since Gary's talking about, you know, post-Newtonian physics, and it's, we're already in a post-Newtonian physics realm and world scientific thinking, you know, we're with Einstein and Planck and Bohr and Heisenberg and Bohm and you know, all the others that basically ushered in the post-Newtonian realm of physics. you know, we kind of maybe get a little bit of that intellectually, but the implications that just blew those physicists away decades ago was that, you know, wait a minute, thought and mind can no longer be just sort of like something we sort of tack on and try to fit into a theory somewhere. It's fundamental to how physics works with, you know, the dual slit experiment that said that, you know, you can't observe something without changing it. Well, that basically means that mind is no longer just something you can, you know, kind of conveniently explain away. It's like this is the primary. So, you know, we literally are making the world with our thought, and which kind of gets back to, you know, the ancient mystical traditions, and certainly, of course, in miracles, that, you know, what we see is an outward picture of an inward condition.
Exactly.
And so if we kind of try to ignore that, we're just going to make ourselves miserable, and there's no point in that. So,
well, and absolutely, and remembering always that I'm the one who made up the criteria by which I've decided I will be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the one who said, oh, if I had this house, oh, if this man would marry me, oh, if my children would do these things, oh, if I looked like, you know, I can't even think of who I would like to look like. Anyway.
Usually some actress or sports celebrity or something like that, right?
Yeah, if this were that and this were that and this were that, then everything would be cool. I would really like my life. And so we're making up these criteria and then deciding whether or not we're going to be happy with less than that result, because you're never going to achieve that result. And even if you do, it's only going to be momentary because of the nature of this illusion is just constantly moving. So I make up the criteria that says this is what will make me happy, and then I can never find it. You know, seek but do not find. It will never occur to me. And even if it does, it is, like I said, just momentary. You know, I bought that new car, and now all of a sudden, you know, it's got, you know, 100 miles on the odometer, and I'm hearing a clinking noise, or my air conditioner is not working right, or, you know, there's always going to be something wrong, no matter how perfect things may seem in the dream. It's impossible because of the impermanence, the temporary nature of the dream. So, you know, it can never make us satisfy us. And it's something that Carrie just posted in the room, which I think is really very interesting, is talking about potential. The word potential generally refers to a currently unrealized ability. The term is used in a wide variety of fields, from physics to the social sciences, to indicate things that are in a state where they are able to change in ways ranging from the simple release of energy by objects to the realization of abilities in people. And I don't know where you got that from, but it's interesting. Yeah, mm-hmm. Potential is, you know, it's in electronics, electricity. It's, you know, it says something more can happen. Something is able to occur, potential.
You haven't been fully zapped yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Using the electrical term.
But the perception of potential, the perception that things can be changed, and that they must be changed, and all that perception of potential even says is that what I see is not perfect. What I see is not perfect, and it must be changed. And you know, I think that the you know, what could I ever see that could be perfect, that would give me happiness and bring me joy? Nothing. There's nothing in this world. Even the most joyful thing is going to make me sad at some point. So,
that's duality.
Okay.
Which is what we're just talking about, huh?
That's exactly. So, Gary's saying, talking about the steps on the ladder to pure non-dualism. He says that first there's dualism. That's where consciousness comes from. Even though the universe is a projection, you don't know it. In order to have consciousness, you have to have something else to be conscious of. That's separation. That's why the Course uses the word awareness to describe spirit. It's something that's not the same as consciousness. Spirit is oneness. There is no subject and object. just wholeness. And actually, all this, when you say oneness, wholeness, the ness is actually saying it's like one, like being whole, mm-hmm. but actually it's one. There's no oneness, there's no like, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. there's just one.
Right. The ness is just something that it was a reminder that it's all the same. But as long as we make a difference out of it, then it's a monster, as a Loch Ness monster, right?
You are killing me. Okay, I love it. So he says, but whether it's your personal experience or the subject of spirituality with dualism, you have two seeming worlds, the world of man and the world of God. Both seem to be true. Next, there's semi-dualism. That's a condition where the mind is beginning to accept that the idea of separation may not be true. You could think of semi-dualism as a kinder, gentler form of dualism. For example, you see a different attitude among religious people who are in a state of semi-dualism. They may start to accept the idea that God is love. But along with this comes important questions. For example, if God is love, can he also be hate? If God is perfect love, as the Bible says, can he also have imperfect thoughts? Questions are being raised, and awareness is slowly beginning to awaken in the spiritual student's mind. As a result, the person may not feel as isolated as people who are in a state of dualism. By the way, at any time during the process of climbing the ladder, you may slip back and forth from one condition to another. It can be a turbulent trip, but at times it will be peaceful. Okay, so that's part two, is the semi-dualism. And then there is non-dualism. Non-dualism, part three, says there's no such thing as separation, and anything that appears to be separate is not real. The projection is undone in your mind, and you go from being at a position of effect to a position of cause. Now you're no longer the dream, but the dreamer. And the dream is not being dreamed by somebody else. There is nobody else. Non-dualism is non-two-ness. There is only oneness. Wasn't there a cat, Tunis?
I don't know, but, well, Tunis, maybe.
Tunis, yeah, that was a cat.
Tunis that drives the car, yeah. But I know that one of the Monty Python films was filmed in Tunisia, but that's as close as I can get to a bad pun at the moment, I guess.
Oh, okay. So there's not two-ness, there's only oneness, and only one reality. So of the two seeming worlds, the world of illusion, which is not true, and the world of reality, which is true, only the world of reality is true, and anything that appears to take on form is untrue. Which brings us to pure non-dualism. The reason it's pure is that it acknowledges God as the only source and the only reality. Yes, there may appear to be two separate worlds, the world of God and the world of man, but only the world of God is true, and nothing else is true. It's rare for a person to be able to acknowledge and accept this, because it means the relinquishment of any form of personal identity, whether body or soul, now and forever. You know you are soon going to disappear into God and take on the higher life of spirit. You will have the awareness of perfect oneness, but not consciousness. Yet through brief glimpses, you'll learn that the experience of awareness blows away the experience of consciousness. This makes the dream world of illusions completely meaningless, except for the way it can be used by anyone to return to the reality of God. And that really reminds me of in the Course of Miracles, in the Manual for Teachers, the discussion of the development of trust, and in which he says there, there's the four steps in the development of trust, and they kind of follow this particular, interestingly enough, this particular little format, because it's all about, let me get to it, and
I think you might be referring to the fifth step, which is where we lose all sense of separate identity altogether. And, right. and he says, and this may take a long, long time. I've kind of almost memorized it, but you know, the idea hopefully, but not the form. But then then the closing sentence in that paragraph is something to the effect of, you know, this would be really difficult except for the fact that every step is so heavily reinforced. Yeah. And which is basically, I think, what that last sentence in Gary's book suggests, you know, except for the way that it can be used by anyone to return to the reality of God. And that's again, using our classroom that the Holy Spirit has of forgiving our dreamer. And, you know, it appears that we're forgiving the dream initially, but eventually we realize that, well, the only thing that really works is forgiving the dreamer, forgiving the decision maker, and shifting our identity back to the decision maker, where we can once and for all at one point just say, hey, I don't even have to dream of duality at all.
Exactly.
There's no point of that. Why would I go there? You know, kind of thing.
Yes. And that's what this, that you're right. That's exactly what that says. So it says that now he must attain a state that may remain impossible to reach for a long, long time. What is the state that is going to be impossible or seem impossible to reach for a long, long time? Well, he says it right here. The state is he must learn to lay all judgment aside and ask only what he really wants in every circumstance.
Exactly.
You get to a state where you learn to lay all judgment aside and just ask, what is this? What do I want?
Yeah.
Not me deciding, I'm going to ask the Holy Spirit to inform me about everything.
Yeah, and what better, you know, kind of archetype for duality than judgment? I mean, judgment requires a subject and an object. It requires something better or less or different or in some way apart. And that's just doesn't make us happy.
Exactly.
In fact, the real simple part, simple, you know, the grassroots thing here is it doesn't make us happy, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So even non-dualism, if it's not pure non-dualism, semi-dualism or whatever, it's going to cause you unhappiness because there's still judgment involved.
Uh-huh.
But when you go through the step of letting go of judgment and just listening only for the Holy Spirit to inform you, then you do get to this period of achievement that Jesus is talking about here in the development of trust. And he says it is here that learning is consolidated. Now what was merely seen as merely shadows before becomes solid gains to be counted on in all quote-unquote emergencies as well as tranquil times. Indeed, the tranquility is the result, the outcome of honest learning, consistency of thought, and full transfer. This is the state of real peace, for here is heaven's state fully reflected. From here, the way to heaven is open and easy. In fact, it is here. Who would, quote-unquote, go anywhere if peace of mind is already complete? And who would seek to change tranquility for something more desirable? What could be more desirable than this? So that's it.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of that Shakespeare quote of, you know, the metal more attractive, you know, basically that's what we think. We think that somehow there's something in this world that's going to do it for us, and that's the ego's carrot on a stick. It's you know, it's sabotage and it's deception and it's whole, you know, political strategy of trying to keep us rooted in a dream that doesn't really serve us, unless we turn it around and use it as a way to get out of the dream. You know, the way to find joy in a joyless place is to recognize you're not there. And back to today's workbook lesson, if there is no world, and that's the central thought that Course attempts to teach, then recognizing that, you know, leads us, and that workbook lesson goes on to say that the reality is what we really want, and the real world, which is not a world of form at all, but a world of spirit, does offer everything we want, and we don't have to do anything to earn it or learn it. We just have to accept it, and the way to accept it is to deny the barriers we put in our mind to it. So that's and to let go of those judgments. You know, that is that last step before the sixth stage of trust, huh?
Exactly, and that's it. I mean, that if you can even consider doing that on a regular basis, it is going to move you quite a bit further up that ladder.
Mm-hmm.
and here's something that somebody brought up the other day, and there's been some little discussion about it, is where Jesus says to us, I think in chapter 2, and they brought this up because of the new edition from Robert Perry and his folks of the Course, and I think it's kind of emphasized in there that Jesus says that it took, you know, millions of years for us to get here, and it's going to take millions of years for us to get back. And so, you know, this person is saying, well, what's the point? And, you know, we've got all this guilt and we can't get rid of it. And, you know, just having some, you know, pretty negative thoughts about the potential. but so many places that Jesus says to us, even one miraculous thought, one miracle-minded thought can save thousands of years. You know, if you just had one miracle-minded thought, it could save you 1,000 years. Well, 1,000 miracle-minded thoughts is 1,000,000 years. You know, there, and how many miracle-minded thoughts do you have, and how many miracle-minded thoughts do people have? We are saving ourselves millions of years by doing this work. So, you know, don't get stuck and hung up in thinking that, you know, there's
some... No harm in that, huh?
Oh, yeah. You know, just knowing that our miraculous thoughts... not because, you know, we're being given brownie points for thinking miraculous thoughts, is because we're changing our thinking. And when I change my mind and perceive, change what I'm seeing, then I accept the correction of my mind. The atonement is complete, and there is no more hell on earth. You know, it is, you know, we are in heaven. It's just as simple as that. It's not being a bliss ninny and trying to skip steps. It's looking realistically at what I'm doing and deciding for the Holy Spirit. You know, there's nothing unrealistic about that, and that is what shifts and saves us thousands of years in this illusion. So, yeah, we are on a big speed up. It says it in chapter 2 in all the versions of the Course. And all you have to do is have these miracle-minded thoughts. So certainly makes it worth it to me to do that.
Yeah, and there's no suggestion to become anxious or to feel like there's something that you have to do in the world. And the Course very specifically says, I need to do nothing, meaning that there isn't anything that's part of the curriculum of A Course in Miracles that says to change or modify in any way what you do or don't do in the world. In fact, you know, in one of the manual sections it says, you know, are changes required in the lives of God's teachers? Well, no, not usually, and except in rare circumstances. And of course, everybody thinks, well, oh, it's got to be I must be one of those rare circumstances where I'm supposed to, you know, go off and do something different with my life, my career, and change who I live with, or where I work, or, you know, all this. My body regimens, all, you know, all that stuff. And it's like, no, just, you know, be normal. Just, you know, if you make a big deal out of the world, then we're back to square one again. And we're back in the ego's dumpster, you know, trying to decorate the walls of the dumpster instead of climbing the heck out of there. So.
Exactly. You know, get some Febreze because my dumpster stinks. Anyway.
Really? Mine too. All of our dumpsters are the same. Yeah.
Okay. So, Persa then says, thank you, Gary, true and brief. Now tell us a joke. So, Gary, with his terrible jokes, says, okay.
I love Gary's jokes.
I know, I do too. This is my shortest jokes. But this one is just a groaner. Jesus walks into a hotel and he goes up to the front desk. He's got these four big old rusty nails with him. He plops the nails down on the front desk and he says,
ba-dum-bum.
Ba-dum-bum, to the guy behind the desk, can you put me up for the night?
Cute.
And let's see. So Persa says, very irrelevant. Nadav would like it because... Nadav liked that kind of crazy stuff. Getting back to non-duality, the Gnostics use the word gnosis in much the same way the Course uses the word knowledge. In both cases, we're not talking about intellectual knowledge or the imparting of information. We're talking about having the actual experience of your perfect oneness of God. You've had the experience the Course calls revelation, right? Okay, and that's what I was just talking about earlier. You've had these experiences. You may not have recognized the experiences. You may have thought the experience was, you know, some anomaly, or, you know, you had some brain chemical fart, or, you know, something happened. But, you know, you heard something, you saw something, you experienced something. And or you might have thought it was a dream. Many times people have mystical experiences or experiences of revelation and don't recognize it as being that because they don't have any context no criteria to assimilate it through. So that's what, you know, I'm saying, you know, go back and look at those experiences whenever you felt touched by the hand of God. And instead of rejecting it, contemplate it, look at it, feel it. What was I doing? What was the feeling? Where, you know, what was my reaction? You know, try to remember how it felt to have that connection to your source, because it's through that remembering of the connection over and over and over that we open our hearts to receive it. If you can't imagine what it feels like, if you can't imagine what God is, your imagination is going to tell you something that's a story, like the old guy with the beard. But if you have the feeling and experience of having connection with your divine, then you don't have to imagine. All you have to do is remember that. And when you remember that, it will become more real to you. And as it becomes more real to you, you'll realize your deep longing for that connection. You're going to realize how your heart is yearning for that connection. And you're going to look for every opportunity that you can find to find that connection. And the greatest opportunity to find the connection to your divine spirit is the connection to your brother. Is connecting to, you know, maybe someone who you didn't think you could ever love, someone who you thought was just a real jerk, someone who you thought was really wonderful and then you became disappointed in. You know, all of these thoughts that you have about your brother, if you can just see your way to letting go of your grievances and accepting your brother as being the whole and healed Son of God, then you will find yourself letting go of your own self accusation, your own grievances against yourself, and you'll find yourself remembering and recognizing your own connection to your Father. This is how we do it. This is why forgiveness is so important. It's not because, you know, you want to be a better person and forgive the world. It has nothing to do with your personal decision to judge one way or another anything. It has to do with your decision to see it right, see it correctly, which today's lesson is all about. When you learn to see the world correctly, then you will no longer have an attachment to it, because all you thought it was bullshit. Let go of it, and you'll see, you know, the truth and reality of what has really happened in here, and you can hold no grievance. These lessons make perfect sense then.
Mm-hmm. And our classroom then, using your recent description, becomes the fertilizer for the Holy Spirit's garden to grow, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Use the BS for something else. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, do you want to continue reading?
Sure. I think we just finished his joke. Okay, Percy said, very irreverent. Nadav would like it. Garden. Now, getting back to non-duality, the Gnostics use the word gnosis, and that's always G-N-O-S-I-S, in much the same way that the Course uses the word knowledge. In both cases, we're not talking about intellectual knowledge or the imparting of information. We're talking about having the actual experience of your perfect oneness with God. You've had the experience of the Course calls revelation, right? Gary, yes, same thing. Revelation in the Course doesn't mean that special information is revealed to you. It's referring to an experience that is so amazing it's literally indescribable, way beyond words. And the word I usually use is ineffable, but that's a word too. The experience of the awareness of perfect oneness blows away anything this world has to offer. It gives you a taste of the truth that is a constant state rather than the impermanence of the dream. And you're saying that some Gnostics experience the same thing, a reality beyond the veil of the illusory universe? Arden, absolutely. There have always been people who experienced that. It can happen to anyone at any time. And you don't have to be spiritually advanced in order for it to hit you by surprise. I say, quote, surprise, unquote, because it usually happens when you don't expect it. Like the Spanish Inquisition, right? So the people reading this shouldn't waste their time looking for it. Also, if it happens, it doesn't make you special. In some cases, the Holy Spirit is helping you to have that experience in order to encourage you to keep going. Plus, there are very advanced students who don't have that experience in this lifetime. But how do they know that they didn't already have it in another lifetime? There's no sense of trying to figure it out. Figuring out why it happens to some and not to others. Just understand that it happens to every mind at some time or another. It's kind of like a preview of coming attractions. You get a sense of what your reality is eventually going to always be like outside of time. Gary, the orgasmic aspect of it is awesome too. We made up our relationships in this world as a substitute for the relationship we thought we lost with God. But sex in this world pales by comparison. That's because only minds can join in a permanent way. Bodies can't really join. Not that we won't try, but union with God takes place through the mind, which, as you said, activates the experience of spirit. You know, I always kind of figure, gee, if that was the be-all, end-all, you'd only have to do it once, right?
Exactly. And it's interesting that he brings up this orgasmic aspect and sex in the world. Because that's something that has been a real topic that the folks who have that new combined edition of A Course in Miracles that the Circle of Atonement put out, all the stuff that Jesus told Helen to take out about their discussions about sex, they've all been put back in there, and there's a whole big, like, lots of talk in the Course community now about the proper use of sex. And, it's quite titillating, to be sure, because, of course, people, when you hear the word sex, and people are just thinking, oh, this means this, and this means that, and they give it their own meanings, and then think that Jesus had an opinion about it, which, you know, I can guarantee you 100%, without a doubt, no doubt whatsoever, Jesus has no opinion whatsoever about sex or any other activity that's being done in the world by the body, by by the ego.
What world? I got to just read today's workbook lesson or kind of get that reminder. It's like, wait, when we start thinking about that there's something in the world that, you know, is important, but it's always about the mind that's important, right?
Exactly. And you know, why Jesus would even, of course you wouldn't put, just like you wouldn't put a whole bunch of stuff in here about, you know, eating meat or, you know, whatever thing, torture, you know, whatever thing that people do with their bodies, that doesn't belong in the Course in Miracles. There's no need for a description or discussion about it. Either the world is real or it's not. You know, in today's lesson, as you said, you know, let go. But, you know, I ramble. Anyway.
Some of that reminds me of the ultra J.P. Sears and his ultra spiritual video series. If you haven't seen those, they're pretty hilarious. You know, just because he actually in the process of looking at you know what's considered new age stuff. I just found the link. I'll put it in the chat here for if you want to share it. He's got all these videos of being ultra spiritual and in a way he's kind of lampooning the level of confusion that is so. Not to make poke fun of specific people, at least that's how I would use it, is to not do that, but just to look at ourselves and with a really gentle sense of humor, just say, wow, look at all the ways that we make it about the form, you know, and like Gary says in his books, you know, whether you're having sex or not having sex, whether you're eating the food that you like or not eating the food you like, whether you're living in the place you want to live or not living in the place you want to live, or you know, have the financial or the career situations that you'd want or not, you know, all that stuff is ultimately irrelevant to the spiritual progress that this curriculum is talking about, right? So I mean, there's nothing wrong with any of it, but there's nothing that's going to make us happy either. So, you know, why make a big deal? You know, Shakespeare says, "Much ado about nothing." Here,
exactly.
A whole lot of nothing going on, yeah.
So you know, let's not drag the course into this stuff, and let's not drag this stuff into the course.
Yeah.
You know, silly. So, okay, you want to continue reading? We have about 6 more minutes.
Sure. Maybe we can get to the bottom of the page at least, huh? Okay. Persis says, "The Course describes your relationship with God as intensely personal, and it is. The Gnostics treasure that experience of gnosis. To achieve it, they try to remember the world is just a dream, as you read in the Gospel of Truth. To them, the world wasn't made by God, but by a demiurge, which is roughly equivalent to the Course term ego, and they were trying to transcend it and go back to reality, which was called pleroma in some of the Gnostic traditions. But the students would often get discouraged if the experience of gnosis didn't happen for them, making a false idol out of the experience and being disappointed if it didn't happen won't get you anywhere. Then, of course, a lot of them made the same mistake most people do. They made the world real. They gave truth to their illusions, so many of them remain in a state of duality, just as many Course students do. Another error they made was to identify with their projection. Today, many students are taught to look at something in the world and say, quote, 'I am that,' unquote. But in fact, you are not that. Anything you see out there in the universe is a symbol. It's a projection, a hologram that's symbolic of that which is buried in your own unconscious mind. Though some of it is symbolic of wholeness, most of it's based on separation. Yes, it's representative of what's hidden in your mind, but it's not you. You don't want to identify with it. You want to forgive it, especially if it affects you in any kind of a negative way. It may seem noble to be one with the universe until you remember there is no universe." There is no world. Well, we come back to where we started in this morning's conversation. "What you want to be is one with God, which is all that truly exists." So that might be a good place to stop and maybe comment on that for a moment. I wanted to say one thing about that first sentence that I read is, you know, "The Course describes your relationship with God as intensely personal," and it is. I think in my mind, I sort of, again, find words that work for me. To me, the personal, I have so many associations with separation with that. So I kind of go with transpersonal, that there is an identity and an awareness that we all share that's transpersonal, that I think is, you know, a profoundly wonderful experience that we just get glimpses of from time to time. And that's, I think, what they were talking about here, is those revelatory kinds of experiences that have to be transpersonal, but there is an identity. It's not like there's no identity. It's like the identity, instead of being a droplet that thinks it's separate from the ocean, becomes the ocean. And it's that oceanic identity and that intense awareness of capitalist self that is really beyond the scope of the course. That's really the love that's beyond the curriculum of forgiveness, which is the not know curriculum of the course. And so, you know, as Ken Wapnick points out in some of his talks, is, you know, the reason it's not a course in love or truth or being or even peace, you know, it's basically saying, it's really a course in not know. It's a course in letting go of all the barriers that we've made, which is usually termed ego, and seeing that isn't serving us, and not making a big deal out of it, but just gently, quietly looking at our judgments and condemnations and saying, you know, that's not working out for me. I just need to get off this trip and you know, get back on the mental track of forgiveness, which is using the dream to forgive the dream. And you know, the one thing within the dream that helps to undo the rest of it, and that's what seems to work, huh?
It is what seems to work. And I'm thinking, when we're talking about this concept, the lesson 189, which is, "I feel the love of God within me now." And when you're thinking about that, and you know, I've read that, you know, done that lesson so many times, and come up saying, "What the hell? I don't feel the love of God." And You know, this would be a great feeling if that was what I was feeling, is the love of God within me now. But, you know, then, you know, Jesus is really clear about what it is. He says, you know, you have this light. You don't know it. You can't see it. You can't experience it because it's not sensible. And which means not sensible as in you cannot sense it.
mm-hmm.
Although sensible is another word. It's interesting. But he says, you know, when you feel the love of God within you, you see nothing but love and joy and everything is wonderful in your life. And this is the world of the love of God reveals. It is so different from the world you see through darkened eyes of malice and of fear that one belies the other. Only one can be perceived at all. The other one is wholly meaningless, a world in which forgiveness shines on everything and peace offers its gentle light to everyone is inconceivable to those who see a world of hatred arising from attack, poised to avenge, to murder, and destroy. Yet is the world of hatred equally unseen and inconceivable to those who feel God's love in them. Their world reflects the quietness and peace that shines in them, the gentleness and innocence they see surrounding them, the joy with which they look out from the endless wells of joy within. What they have felt in them, they look upon and see its sure reflection everywhere. So, you know, what would I want to see? He asks this is next question. What do you want to see? Well, you know, I want to see that gentle world, and yet I choose over and over and over to see the world of conflict, the world of fear, the world of war, the world of politics, the world of religion, the world of culture. You know, I'm choosing to see a world of want and smallness and not the world that God has given us. So, the whole idea, in that lesson, and I know our time is up, but I'm just going to really quickly move on here. in recognizing that, you know, what he says to us in this lesson 189, which we've always know, is simply do this: be still and lay all side of all thoughts of what you are and what God is, all concepts you've learned, all images you hold. Empty your mind of everything it thinks is true or false or good or bad, or every thought it judges worthy, all the ideas of which it is ashamed. Hold on to nothing. Do not bring with you one thought past what the past has taught you, nor one belief you ever learned before from anything. You know, either you're going to see that world or you're going to see God's world. And he's saying, don't hold on to that. Hold on to nothing. And then and he says, forget this world. Forget this course. Come with holy empty hands unto your God. That really is the peace of God. You know, when we drop everything that we believe is real and true in this world and we accept ourselves as the Holy Son of God in the holy instant, in the holy instant with our brother, we are all the same and perfect. Oneness is our state. You know, I think oneness is a state. And in that state, joy, happiness, grace, you know, that's what it is. Anyway, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, for being with me.
Thank you, Lynn. And it's always a pleasure and a joy to converse. And thanks to everyone who's listening and participating and resonating. And we know that minds are joined we're not healed alone. So anyway, have a great week, everyone.
All right. Love you, Bruce. Talk to you next week.
Likewise. Thanks.